And you want to do an end as well.
Exactly. But we'll do it in, we'll do it in spots so it makes it easier for me.
Yeah.
Right, go.
Welcome to Reboot Republic, the podcast that goes behind the headlines and looks at the big issues in this republic of inequality. We are the podcast of solutions and the podcast of hope. And I'm your host, Rory Hearn. And today we have the first of three episodes which cover our Reboot 100 Live, which we had, which was an absolutely incredible event with a range of guests covering issues from housing, homelessness, inequality, discrimination, inspiration. And we can listen to the full Reboot Live over on patreon.com. And as always, we'd encourage you to become a supporter of Reboot Republic over to patreon.com/tortoiseshack. And we really hope you enjoy this first of the three podcasts of Reboot Live. And also, if you're interested, the Home a Human Right Conference is being held in Maynooth on April 22nd and April 23rd. Lots of speakers, international speakers, covering the areas of public housing, social housing, how we can get affordable housing, and how we can get the right to housing in policy and in our constitution. Go over to check it out on Maynooth, Home a Human Right. So I hope you enjoy this, and we'll talk to you soon. Welcome to Reboot Republic Live, the podcast that goes behind the headlines and looks at the big issues in this republic of inequality. We are the podcast of solutions and the podcast of hope. And I'm your host, Rory Hearn, and I'm privileged to be joined tonight by my co-host, Senator Lynn Ruan, and a panel of inspiring guests. Lynn, thank you so much for being here and marking this big event.
You're very welcome. You're lucky. You're lucky you got me. I've done about three evening events this week, and I usually try and keep it at a minimum of three a month.
But I know we're really lucky because you're super famous now. And the last time you were on was 3 years ago in one of the first podcasts. I look back, it was episode 13. And we talked about a thing called social class, which kind of you probably aren't much aware about anymore.
Oh my God. Yeah, I'm, do you know what? I'm even more aware of it because I've now experienced different elements of it. So, you know, when you go from having the absence of capital to having capital, it makes you even a little bit more of an expert.
No, fascinating. No, it is. It's so great to have you.
Obviously.
Of course. And listen, so we are here. We're here with the 100th episode of season two. And next month, we turn 3 years since we started the very first episode, which was on social housing, one of the issues very close to my heart. And we had Mick Byrne, who is with us here tonight, who was on the first episode. Mick, thanks so much for being here again.
Thanks, Rory. I can't believe you've made it this far after that first episode.
I know Tony was joking before that you thought that was going to be the last one.
Yeah, I tried to wreck it for you, but you survived me.
We survived and thrived, Mick. I was looking back at old WhatsApp messages between me and Tony and getting it started, and it was actually April 2018, so exactly 3 years ago. Tony texted me, he said, "What's the crack, Batman? Want to get something started on the In My Perfect World thingy," which was this idea we'd been talking about setting out, you know, what would be the alternatives instead of to counteract the centrists and the right saying, oh, nothing is possible and things are the way they are. And he said, maybe do a couple of episodes, maybe 10 or 12. And I threw out a few names. We had Remaking the Republic, The Common Sense, and we came up with Reboot Republic. And it's funny looking back, I sent him one message in May 2018. Hugh, you like this. I said to him, have you had that guy on from Oculon yet? He's great. And then one of my favorite ones was I texted him in June 2018. I said, Tony, can we do a podcast in a hotel room? Tony, are you there?
I was there and I had to go and set up a podcast with the UN Special Rapporteur in a hotel room while there was samba music playing outside and some sort of Brazilian night going on. And God bless her. I don't know. To this day, she still manages to take our calls. I don't know why.
I know. It was a great podcast. Lynn, it's going to be a bit of fun. Interesting.
I'm wondering what Tony did before podcasts. Like, because in my head now, he lives in this place or this island called the Tortoise Shack. Like, he lives in this place and it's a thing. You know, that kind of conceptual thing of gangland. Well, like, that doesn't exist and it's actually part of society. Well, in my head, Tony lives in Tortoise Shack. And I'm just kind of amused and wondering what happened beforehand.
Honestly, what happened is I brought down the country in the banks. That's what happened. And now I hide here and hope not to get in trouble for it. I'll be found out as the rabid capitalist that I really am.
That's what I said to Tony Alder. This is all just trying to assuage his conscience for fucking us all up in the crisis and crash. So, and he's doing a good job of it. He is doing a good job. He's hiding now.
Yeah, go on. Move along.
move along. Lena, we've got a whole load of guests here, which we're going to try and squeeze out of them. They are change makers and thinkers and dreamers and doers. What their ideas are around kind of what the big issues for them in terms of inequality, what they want to highlight, and the solutions as well. So I was going to start with doing my little kind of issues and hopes, and then I was going to hand over to you. Are you happy enough with that?
Yeah.
Okay, let's go. So I think that for me, the pandemic has changed everything. But in the area of inequality, it has worsened things. And the thing is interesting, I think that in many ways, inequalities have been worsened and exacerbated. And the figures were just thrown out there from Forbes that we've seen a new billionaire every 17 hours during COVID, while 150 million people have been pushed into global poverty. And of course, our tax regime facilitates those billionaires globally to avoid tax, which is something we've highlighted recently on Reboot. And they funnel their wealth into property here and extract rent then from generation rent. But it's been very, I have to say, deeply saddening and really horrendous to see the growth in inequality in Ireland too during the pandemic. And figures from St. Vincent de Paul show that a quarter of people have had to cut back on food, heating or electricity due to the pandemic, due to related loss of income, which of course is causing massive stress to households. And those who are experiencing the most adverse financial impacts are many of the groups that were vulnerable to poverty before the pandemic. Low-income families with children, lone parents, renters, and people with disabilities. And of course, we've also seen something that we'll touch on this evening, the COVID inequality in relation to women bearing the burden of care responsibilities and being excluded from policy decisions. We have seen global investors busier than ever buying up housing, locking out generation rent from affordable homes, with government leasing, getting social housing from leasing them. We've got our lucrative tax breaks. And house prices and rent simply are not sustainable still, despite the pandemic. We need a new approach to housing, treating it as a home, a fundamental human need and right, not a speculative investment. There's huge discrimination in housing as well, in the housing system, resulting in massive homelessness, which continues. For migrants, for those on HAP, for travellers, for those with disabilities. And poverty and inequality fuel despair as well and affect people's self-worth and mental health. It affects families, it affects their health. And we see it in youth, in young people, being misled and groomed into drugs and violence, which is worsening. We see it in the north, and we see it in disadvantaged communities in the south, which results from a structural violence of state neglect and disinvestment, which results in traumatizing children and young people. Something that I know a number of our guests have looked at and are, you know, talking about it. Very important to highlight the trauma and the links between trauma and inequality. But there's hope as well in approaching this crisis. We've seen so far, rather than cutting back, we've seen government spending, we've seen investment, we've seen the starts of new housing models like cost rental and Ó Cualann. We've seen family homelessness reducing from an eviction ban and housing that had been available to tourist lets. It shows what can be done. There's growing momentum for a right to housing, for a new normal after the pandemic, and a fundamental change that's needed for our economic model that is destroying the climate, destroying our future, one to a circular economy. We need one where health, care, social connection, well-being, climate is prioritized over capital growth and profits. We need a society built on solidarity, against discrimination, on values of cooperation. We need a future that puts people and planet first. The question is, are we getting closer to a republic of equality and rights? We're seeing growing societal demand for change. It was visible in the last election. We've seen positive community action like St. Michael's Estate, Oscar Traynor, the work of inclusion and health, the great work of teachers and school communities, childcare workers, the Big Start campaign, the Traveller movement, Black Lives Matter, and young people in community and youth workers. The point that we always try to highlight in Reboot Republic is that inequality is not inevitable. Inequality is a social construction that results from the way in which our societies, economies, and politics are organized. The hospital waiting list for those reliant on the public system, the thousands of children left living in hotels and hubs, the lack of mental health services, the failure to make substantive changes to address climate, allowing hundreds of thousands left in poverty, they all result from political and policy choices, a decision not to put the resources where they could affect change. So we must and we will continue to work to change those choices and priorities. So thank you all for being here tonight. You are the hope. We are the present and the future, the change makers, the activists, the dreamers, the creators of a republic of equality and rights. You are the voices that make Reboot Republic, the unique podcast that we hope highlights the inequalities and social issues, but also brings the solutions and alternatives. You've made it the success it is today, and without you contributing as guests, as patrons, as listeners, we wouldn't exist. So I look forward to hearing you all in relation to these issues of inequality and hope for change. And thank you for your ongoing support for Reboot Republic. Now, Lynn, over to you.
Rory, you could at home you put that much like preparation into your political broadcast.
I couldn't help myself, Lynn.
So I'm thinking about tonight. Obviously, what kind of fluttered through my head is the things that we all care about and think about, right? From housing to the big social issues to direct provision to equality to poverty to all those things. All those big ticket items that it seems like we keep providing the solutions for and somebody keeps kind of ignoring that the solutions are there and committing to failed policies, which is something that I always struggle to understand when people can't, like, it's like... Now, I'll go on much more of a ramble, so I hope he's all follow me. Then Rory was very succinct and, you know, so he'll have to just bear with me. So for me, when we look at those big policy things, we have political parties that are married to those policies. But they're not political parties that are void of intelligence and logic and reason. So I always struggle to understand how they don't apply the skills and the education that they have to recognizing when something isn't working, which for me then points to the idea that we're ignoring what's not working. And then that's even something else to think about. Why would you ignore what's not working? What does that say about us as people? Does that mean that we are so afraid to maybe address the fact that the things we thought we knew aren't accurate? So we'd rather try and stick to the thing that's not working to be right rather than admit to be wrong. And I think there's something to be said about that on a human level, because behind the institutions, behind the politicians, behind the decisions are humans making human decisions and applying human thought processes to things. And how do we get into that? And that's the thing for me. That's the issue for me, is how do we get into the mindset where people are afraid to be wrong and afraid to admit that the 20 years they spent advocating for something, do you know what? Jesus, I really got that wrong. Nobody is saying that. Why is nobody saying that? They try and manipulate the information. So they're only a little bit wrong and now they're going to try this avenue. But nobody ever goes, you know what? How bad was all of that? Let's completely revamp how we've done that. And That's what's always amazed me from like a human capacity type thing, like, and what's going on for people that they can't have that introspection. And not only can they not have that introspection, but then they are supported and facilitated by co-workers and colleagues and fellow politicians in that group thing space to go, yeah, no, we didn't get it wrong. It just, you know, we just need to keep trying the same thing that we've tried. You know, it's like the Einstein stuff. It's like, you know, how long do we have to get something wrong for before we realize it's, you know, it's bollocks. But it's so that's the kind of stuff I was thinking about today, Rory. And then that kind of spans out into many different places for me. And it brought me on a journey of thinking today just around the language that we use, the narratives that we tell ourselves, and the stories that we convince ourselves of over time to protect us from the reality that we're human, we're flawed, we make mistakes, we mess up, and how do we fix them? And it's like we create a narrative that's so, so strong that you'd nearly think we were all caught in some type of delusional state where we can't ever admit that we're just people that get it wrong sometimes. And that can be on any spectrum of the political spectrum or demographics or geographics. Every human has the capacity to do well, to do wrong, and to be two things at once. So you can be both good and bad at the same time. There's no such, for me, there's no such thing as this absoluteness of who you are and what you are. And you can be more than one thing at one time. And for me, what I was thinking about today is that what I'm hopeful about is how people are beginning to challenge the language that some people use. And to give an example that's taken that kind of philosophical kind of frame that I've put on things and taken it down to like an individual example. So I was sent a document today that was like a scope on Tala. And there was a line in it, and it's looking at funding, like entrepreneurial funding into Tala. And there was a line in it, in the document, that said, so Tala, remember, it's like 120,000 people. Like, it's a city in itself, right? So to make this statement felt very odd to me. And in that statement, in that one line, it said, basically, to paraphrase it, it said, there's no instances of youth entrepreneurship in Tala. I was like, are we not creating some of the most successful drug dealers you've ever met? but basically, like, entrepreneurship exists everywhere in Tala. Everywhere in Tala, and that somebody can come in and reframe like social entrepreneurship to a community that is a community of community workers. Community workers are the original social entrepreneurships. And then the middle class came in and gave us a language to understand social entrepreneurship by, and it wasn't one we recognized. So then we removed ourselves from the conversation, removed ourselves from the funding streams, removed ourselves from all the big national funding for social entrepreneurs, because we're like, what's that? But we are the community workers who built the projects, who built the programs, who built the initiatives, who built the youth projects, who are the social entrepreneurs. So for me, it's like a narrative and a story has been set by a particular class of people, and they're sticking to that narrative, and they've imposed that narrative on other people. And they've imposed it. My issue is they've imposed it to the point that even now in our communities, we don't recognize ourselves. So for me, that's the issue. But then I also see a greater influx of people like me challenging language in a way that I have never seen before. Like, never seen before. Like, my only identification with a working class person in a sphere of education and socialism and all of that was John Bissett. He was my only person that I could point to as a community worker with a PhD who sounded like me, the only person. I'm starting to see it more, and I'm starting to see so many young women who I now go onto their Twitter threads to fucking teach myself a lesson, because they're so articulate, they're so intelligent, and they're challenging that narrative at all cost. And I'm hopeful looking at that. I'm hopeful looking at young working class people challenge a narrative, right down to the point that I have young boys in schools in Killinarden who are now challenging how the teachers impose the rules of the school on them, where they ring me and they check if how they're reading the journal when they open their school journal and it has the list of what they signed up to as rules. They're going, I actually disagree with what that rule says, Lynn, am I right? Do you know what I mean? And it's kind of like there's something happening, and it's not the NGOs, and it's not the political parties, and it's not the people that try and lay claim over change. There's something else happening that's challenging spaces. And I'm hopeful. I'm just really, really hopeful for that. Even down to the Green Party. Like, I've never voted Green in my life, which I'm delighted about, obviously, for good reason. When you look at the system now. But what we see in the Green Party is hopeful, because we've seen a load of people that cared about an issue. And when the party didn't meet that issue and align with that issue, they said bye-bye. And so there's something about young people today that is creating a very new standard for our political representatives and for the parties that they think they align with. They're now holding them accountable, you know? And I think that that's so, so important. And I think years ago, so many of us couldn't even recognize our own rights. let alone exercise our own rights. And I just think there's so many more people now that are able to actually recognize their own rights. So I don't know whether that's all a bit too over the place for that I'm actually even making a concise point. So that's what I'm saying is, I'm saying there's strong narratives that are created. People are afraid to admit when they're wrong. And I think that's a massive human flaw. I don't think it's very respectable to not be able to admit when you're wrong. And what I'm hopeful about is the many, many young voices who are literally using, taking the language that's been imposed on us and challenging it to the point where it's they're like, they're so, so precise when they're taking apart someone's kind of ideology to a point where I'm like, there's light bulbs going off in my head. And I think I'm educating on a subject until I read or hear some of our young activists speak. And I just go, I know nothing. I know nothing. I'm still in the fucking 1990s. Like, do you know what I mean? And I just think that's so exciting. So I leave it at that.
Great, Lynn. That's a really, I think, wonderful, wonderful and thought provoking. And I think you're so right. The idea of interest, of reflection and needing to accept and acknowledge when we're wrong, when we make mistakes, mm-hmm. and to be able to look at that. And I think is so important that, you know, both on the left, you know, anyone in politics, anyone in activism, it's something that we really need to do and reflect on it and to be able to, you know, look at our own, you know, what we do and to accept that, you know, you can't always be right. We're not always right. And to be able to engage in a healthy discussion and model the type of society we want to create as well, I think is so important. And the youth, of course, is I think there is so much hope. And we saw it in the climate strikes as well. And the necessity as well of bringing those voices, of bringing working class voices, of bringing traveler voices, of bringing, you know, people of color, of bringing all the different diversity of voices into the public, because that is our new republic. And hopefully we play a bit of a role in that in Reboot. So thank you so much. And Lynn, do you want to introduce then our first guest?
Yes, actually. So it's Sheridan, isn't it? Sheridan.
No.
Who is it? Oh, my God. It's your son.
Oh, my God.
It's Leo. It's the head of the Herns.
Exactly.
It's the handsome Hern. The only handsome man Hern. Look at that hair.
That you've seen so far.
yeah. So, Leo, you're up next. How did your dad drag you into this?
I think it was just when we have a lot of like chats in general, as you do. And I think we were just having a particularly deep one here. It was like, hey, we should talk about this on the podcast, you know? I think it was really that simple.
Brilliant. And I hope that what we were talking about a minute ago, you know, when people can admit they're wrong and have a bit of introspection, won't you remind your dad of that when he's being like, you know, a typical parent?
I know, he's very good.
So, Leo, you tell us then and chat to us about what issues are relevant for you and your hopes.
Well, I think like the issues for me are the ones that I'm really involved with or seeing. So like kind of, I guess, the big three would be like stuff going on with schools, COVID, and like climate change. Because those are the ones I'm most involved with. So I think like, where are we frozen? Oh, sorry. No, I thought we were frozen.
We're all just listening.
Okay. So for me, I think in schools, like there's everything going on with the Leaving Cert right now. There was loads on. I've had some friends that have had to deal with all that. And I think that was a bit of a mess altogether. But you can see like young voices coming up and talking about it. And like they made a change. They called for like action. And even when they were like originally trying to bring 6 years back and people didn't feel safe and didn't want to go, there was a lot of like actual student voices being like listened to, which is a bit of a change, I think. I think that was really good. And then in the sense of like COVID, I think that there's a good bit of like, oh, kids are off having parties, like they're the fault in here. When I like think that the majority of teenagers are being pretty responsible, you know? I think there's a lot of stuff given out to the teenagers. and then also like not listening to them as well. I think there's a big thing of like lots of discussions going on around people my age, but not many people my age actually being included in the discussions, you know. I think that's a very big thing that's going on. And then obviously climate change, I think in general, that's just such a big thing that really needs to be dealt with. Because like, look at how like mostly we all came together around COVID. Like there was a huge change in the world. Like you've got the mass sanitization, there were global lockdowns, you know? And if you look at the amount of death through COVID compared with like the impact projected for climate change, it's just insane. Like you'd really hope that after something like this, we take a look at ourselves for a moment and be like, wow, there's this thing that's even more like destructive. It'll do so much more than COVID if it isn't addressed. And it's a thing that the whole world needs to come together on. And do something about, you know. I think it's just really important, and I really, really do hope, as you're asking for the hopes, I hope that like the world does come together and change is made, because there's obviously, again, people my age trying to make change. Like there's Greta Thunberg, there's all the Fridays for Future things, you remember the school protests. Like we're trying to make our voice heard and show that this is something really important to us and something that we want change because it's our future, you know. Like all the older people created the issues, were born into this world and trying to do something about it, you know. I think that's
thanks for that, Leo. I think what I'm thinking of when you're speaking there, before I throw back to your dad, I have two questions. One of them is in relation to legislation that myself and Fintan Moorfield have been working on for a few years that gets a bit of kickback, which is the vote at 16. And I suppose when I listen to you speak and I listen to the arguments against 16-year-olds speaking or young people having a democratic right, you know, it's the arguments against it from very, like people that are portrayed as very intelligent men in the country. And then the arguments they give against people voting at 16, one of them being, oh, but we don't allow people to smoke and drink until they're 18. And that came from like, you know, Senator McDougall actually said about drinking at 18. And I'm kind of like, okay, so one is actually possibly bad for your health if you excessively drink, but I've never heard of anybody dying of liver cirrhosis from voting too much. Do you know what I mean? So it's kind of like, I don't really understand that argument. Do you know what I mean? I'm wondering what you think of that, what you think of vote at 16.
Well, yeah, that argument just doesn't make sense to me. Like, drinking, smoking, that's just bad for you. Like, I don't think that has any impact on voting. I think the vote at 16 is hard because like there's a lot of people that are very responsible. voting in moderation, Tony just said. I think there's a lot of people that are very responsible at 16 and would vote and all that. And then there's people that aren't as responsible. But I think that's the same for everyone.
Yeah.
You know? And also in that sense, they're probably a lot less likely to register to vote if they don't care or if they just want to mess with it, you know? The people that really care and want their voices heard are the ones most likely to be voting. And I think they'd be the most progressive, stuff like that, you know? So I think vote at 16, yeah, like I would go for it. Obviously, I'm 16 now. I think like I'd be responsible, I'd research all of it and I'd vote responsibly, you know?
Yeah, no, you're right completely, Leo. And that's the thing that like, if we were to say that you vote more responsibly when you get older, I don't think we'd all be sitting here discussing inequality in the way that we are. So I think the idea of maturity and being responsible with your vote is kind of void when you look at the political system and what it produces. You know, I think people are irresponsible or people don't even research. People vote because of loyalty and family history and all of those things. And they probably never actually look into who they're voting for. I've one more question, right? You mentioned about young people being, you know, seen as irresponsible during COVID and stuff. And, you know, you mentioned the idea that young people are out at parties. And it was the same that was said about working class communities, like that we're all, you know, congregating in houses. Did you feel like me and wonder why you weren't being invited to any of the parties?
No, I think like I know the people around. I know there aren't many, if any, parties going on, you know? Again, I think it's just the whole media thing of wanting to put the blame on someone that can't stand up for themselves, you know?
Okay, well, you're more responsible than me because I was wondering why I wasn't getting invited to all the parties.
But you're outside my 5K, Lynn.
That's because they all know you're so famous now, Lynn. They just wouldn't think you'd respond, you know?
Are they afraid I'd get them into trouble?
They're afraid you might ask them on to, you might go try and do a TV show in their house or something.
Cribs.
Oh, Leo, can I just blubber some parental pride and just say, yeah, you spoke fantastically there, and I'm very proud of you, and the world is very safe in your hands.
Thank you. Well, you're the one who raised me, you know.
Well, yeah, and your mother too.
And my mom, definitely.
And Sinead, and all of us, and the whole community, and all our families, and your schools, and everybody. But no, it is great, and there is so much hope, I think, there in the future. And, you know, we all, and I think that we really, and I've been struck by that listening to you, like I've learned from you, and even the climate thing, you know, that you have renewed in that, or kind of fueled that in me as well, kind of, because it's something I always would have been, and Clina Ní Chealaigh is here, who we would have been activists together over the environment. We won't say how long ago, Clina, but many, many years ago. But, you know,
but we were much closer to Leo's age than our current ages.
I know, that's terrifying. You know, given that as well, that re-inspiration, I think it's so important that your voices are heard. So I really appreciate you doing it all. Thank you so much. I'm such a proud daddy.
Thank you very much.
Okay, Lynn. Thanks, Leo. Thanks. Do you want to, actually, Clina's next. Clina Ní Chealaigh, a regular contributor to Reboot Republic. All
in
around.
Very cool company. I'm like getting the kudos now from hanging out with the cool kids. I might get invited to some parties.
Highly unlikely. Don't say you
can't. That none of us have been invited to a party.
Don't say you were on Reboot Live. It's unlikely to get you a few invites. Lina Ní Chealaigh, you are I suppose, infectious disease expert. You are a published medical author, you are a lecturer, you are expert in working in St. James's, someone who's working in inclusion health. A big area, something of real concern to you and something you've worked on and developed in terms of, for you, what is the kind of big issues that you'd like to highlight and where is the hope for you?
So I absolutely agree that the hope is in the generation is coming up after us, and I'm the proud mam of a 12-year-old and a 7-year-old, and I usually get more sense out of them than I do out of most adults. So I totally agree, and I think that's a really good move to reduce the voting age, because there's a lot of smart, committed, sensible people in that age group that should be allowed to have a voice. And I was reflecting, I mean, what to pick out of all the things that I want to say. But I agree, you know, I think with all three of you, what is both inspiring and disheartening in this pandemic is human nature. And it's inspiring to see how flexible we are. You know, when our back is up against the wall, we can do all kinds of things. And what is disheartening to see is sometimes how illogical the people who are making the decisions are, and how they prioritize short-term gain, or I'm not even sure sometimes what they think they're gaining, for things that are clearly very damaging in the long run. And I was thinking about this on my way home today. I was at a thing yesterday about HIV. So that was my entryway in some ways into inclusion health, which is what I do, which is what's my absolute passion. And HIV is such, you know, taught us so much about what looks impossible. You know, what is possible when you have a committed community. And HIV really brought together, you know, the gay community, African-Americans, people who inject drugs, who really, really had to push incredibly hard to get the US government and other governments to put the money into drug, into research, into medications. And all the good that came out of that community, like now HIV is this amazing condition that we can treat so well. It's one tablet once a day, normal life expectancy. And it's also a condition which highlights the bits that we haven't solved, which is inequality, social exclusion, and how that excludes people from having healthy lives. And actually then, you know, which what Lynn was saying and Leo was saying about the next generation, I think something I've really seen in my lifetime is a massive change in how younger people accept diversity and how much more accepting they are. I think, Lynn, it comes down to that being able to say, I've made mistakes, or I'm not perfect, or I'm not this cardboard cutout, you know, like whatever, 2.5 children and a house in the suburbs. And I think that, you know, if we look at the marriage referendum and all the good that's come out of it, now when I look at the younger doctors and people that I work with, if they're gay, they're out, everybody's totally accepting, you can have long hair, you can have earrings, whereas my generation, which included the other Leo, were pretty feckin' conservative. You know, nobody in my class who was gay was out. They've only since, you know, subsequently come out really when they had to. And so I think that community activism and young people's activism can really change things if we can take those imaginary limits that we have about what we can do as humans. And if we can really look at what is good for all of us and accept that we can do those things, it's just a matter of choosing them. So hats off to your generation. Leo, hopefully you're going to do a better job than we have done so far and keep holding us to account and keep showing us the way forward.
Keena, my daughters always say to me, don't make me responsible for you. Don't make me responsible for you.
It's not their fault that we screwed things up. We screwed things up on our own. But
I think, though, it's important as well, we say that we is not we. Yes, we individually have done pretty crappy, you know, decisions or whatever. But I mean, we are not, you know, the managers or shareholders of BP, unlikely to be many shareholders of BP here anyway. But, you know, our global investors or our members of, you know, political parties that have been power for decades and decades since the foundation of the state and, you know, entrenched it, that, you know, we have in our lives also paved a way for younger people, you know, in all the work that all of us have done. And I don't think we should forget that, you know, just as generations
before us. That's true, Rory. And I think, you know, one of my many things that I try to do every day is I'm involved in teaching the medical students. And my philosophy is, can we just not break them? Like, they're really sound, they're really smart. Can we just not give them, you know, set a bad example? And I think even if we can do that, if we can hold some of that space for them and take them seriously and listen to them and not have them be exposed more than, you know, or support them when they're exposed to stuff that they know is wrong, then, like you're saying, that they ring you and go, is this right? And you're like, no, it's not right. Mm-hmm. If we can do some of that, I think that might help. But yes, Rory, you and I have been saying the same things for a long time, so we can't be held entirely responsible for all that's wrong with the world.
No, we can't. For over 20 years ago, we were activists together, and I think it was you were in the Greens, the Young Greens at the time, if I'll out you. And of course, I was a young socialist at the time. And we were protesting over, I think it was the start of the anti-capitalist protests.
It was.
This battle in Seattle, wasn't it? Back over the World Trade Organization. And
it was about,
Nick would have been around then as well.
Patenting. It was around patenting seeds in India, like stuff that's still really wrong.
Yeah. Third world debt. It was, you know, the injustices. And of course, the heart of it was the rise of the financial corporations and the way in which finance was becoming all powerful within capital and determining financial markets and commodifying everything. And I remember listening to Asian Dub Foundation and reading their lyrics about the IMF and what they were doing in third world countries and going, wow, this is serious. And going off to protest against the IMF in Prague. And little did we know how close they'd come to home years later. But Keena, just in terms of COVID, one question. Where do you see the inequalities within, from a health perspective, within COVID, do you think? You know, so, and how are we seeing those?
I mean, it's really stark, right? And in some ways, that's what's frustrating, because COVID shows us again that poverty and social exclusion, keeping people out, is really bad for their health. And, you know, with any, whether it's, I don't know, societal well-being or, you know, health, we're really only as healthy as the people who we treat the worst in our society. And that's very clear in COVID. And I suppose it's frustrating to see that message still not sinking in fully in some parts of society. And I think this week what was, you know, really clear is those mutations. We got really lucky this time, right? You know, COVID has been absolutely terrible, but it's not as terrible as it could or can be if we don't get our act together. And what's going on in terms of vaccine equity or, you know, not allowing countries to manufacture a vaccine. Again, it's an example of something that doesn't even really give us any short-term gain and definitely will cause long-term problems and is easily solved if you take away that hat of, no, we can't do it. Like, no, now is the time to waive patents and to let, you know, poorer countries manufacture those drugs, those vaccines. Why would you not? Give me one good reason. So I think that inequality could totally still come back and bite us very, very hard. Mm. We don't want, you know, P1 plus taking over, because it could be a lot worse.
Cliona, before I jump on to Sharon there, who's coming up next, I hope Sharon's internet has improved there. I know the last time I had her on a podcast, she had to go out chasing a chicken. So who knows? But
no better woman to chase a chicken.
Cliona, can I ask you before we just move on to Sharon, in speaking about you know, the inequalities around vaccinations, and we can clearly point to what those inequalities look like in less kind of well-off countries, and that it's a very clear abuse of patents and stuff there. But say locally here in Ireland, because we will have say physical access to a vaccination, we see that as somehow that means that you have access to vaccines. But beyond that, what are the inequalities that exist at a very domestic level? Because, you know, the access to information, being susceptible to misinformation and conspiracy, they have to feed in somewhat to the theory of vaccination inequality. You know, so they have to be taken, it has to be taken in all of its understanding of what it means for someone to make a decision around taking a vaccine. Like, listening to my own mother tonight, she was like saying, oh, the Astra, whatever, however you pronounce it, they're saying they won't give it to under 50s, but I'm over 50. So do I not get a vaccine that's good enough for everyone? She's like, I don't understand that. And it's like, so people are scared. And especially if you're from a disenfranchised community, You're even more scared. So that does create an inequality in the vaccine rollout. So how do we begin to address that?
So hallelujah, Lynn, like, this is such an important point. And, you know, yes, absolutely, in vaccines, and very clear in vaccines, it's there in everything else. You know, why don't some people feel welcome in healthcare settings? Like, that's a problem. And that's our problem for not making them feel welcome. So in terms of vaccines, I think, you know, and again, it's that same double whammy, those most at need. Austin O'Carroll taught me this, like, there's this law that the more you need something, the harder it is for you to get it, for multiple reasons. So it's the people who most need to be vaccinated who they're going to be the most barriers. And they don't necessarily trust the state. Like, we had two Roma patients, this is a year ago in ED, who needed a COVID swab, and we organized, we got them a room at a hotel to be isolated. Safety Net was going to go in and swab them. We had a taxi. I was totally patting myself on the head, like, fantastic service. And the taxi came to pick them up. And as it was driving to the hotel, they hopped out of the taxi and legged it, because they were scared that something bad was going to happen. Because to them, you know, the men in white coats and the police car and the taxi and the hotel isn't a friendly setting. So I think we need to own that. And to listen to those communities. And again, it's about fairness. Like, you know, why are middle-class communities more likely to take the vaccine? Because they've had better access to education. They've had all those things. So we need to redress that now. And like, one of the things I love about Dublin or Ireland, and I love many things, is there is a really, like, on some level in normal society, there is a commitment and a sense of solidarity. And a sense that, like, right, we need to make sure that those lads get it as well as these lads. And so we're working, we're setting up a hub to vaccinate all the homeless shielding units. We're thinking really carefully about what we're going to do in the Roma community, get some, you know, Angie Skuse has done really cool work with Roma community leaders. So she's going to use those bridges and that trust that's been built up to get the vaccine out there. We are conscious as well in the traveling community, there can be a lot of concerns around vaccines. So, you know, building on the structures and the respected people in those communities and giving them, you know, basically saying, what do you need, and doing it. But it's so easy to not do that. Like using a PPS number to register our people on the vaccine portal, like be careful, because there's a lot of people who don't have a PPS number who really need to be vaccinated. So you really need to always be thinking, who are we leaving out? Who's not going to feel comfortable, and doing something to make that happen? Because otherwise you're not vaccinating people who need it. Where we're at. It's going to be fun. I can't wait.
What I always found most useful in communities like mine, the traveler community and the migrant community, is that people don't trust the institutions because the institutions have so failed them so many times. Yeah. But they do trust their neighbour, and they do trust their peers, and they do trust maybe one of the more respected families within their community that maybe have a bit of influence. And I always find that when health professionals make an effort to get to know who those important families are, whether it be within the traveling community or a working class community, that sometimes that's your way in.
Oh, absolutely.
Calling out a load of medical advice. It's actually you find who is the influencer, not social influencer, but the influencer in the working class estate that people actually trust. And it's definitely not the medical service, and it might be the man that runs the local running club. Do you know what I mean? It's like, and how you get in there and make those connections.
We have Jana Lyons, who has patiently waited through our 6 series of soon to come Netflix podcasts. But Jana, it is wonderful to have you back again. Is the sound working okay now?
Oh God, I hope so. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you loud and clear. Thank
God. I don't know what happened there. That's never happened before. Sorry about that.
I reckon it was probably someone somewhere in government trying to stop you getting your say.
That's what they all say, Jan.
Yeah, probably. Probably. Well, I wrote something out because I was real conscious to keep it to the 3 to 4 minutes.
For you, in terms of, yes, what's your issue you want to highlight and your hope?
Yeah, well, I'm working as a primary school teacher, and I'm also a trade union activist as well. So 3 minutes isn't long enough to pick just one inequality in education, like Anne-Marie so eloquently described earlier, let alone delve into it deeply enough to give sufficient understanding to anyone working outside of that sector. And the inequalities that our students face are endless, whether that's the school premises not being fit for purpose, their cultures or personal beliefs not being reflected in the classroom, their experience of disadvantage, marginalization, converging with early childhood traumas, which can have lifelong impacts, few supports for traveller children, as we heard earlier, for children with English as an additional language, for children in direct provision or homelessness, a referral system for diagnosis of additional needs with waiting list of 18 months just for the initial appointment, and then schools not being staffed or equipped to help those children reach their potential. And yet, as educators, we need to put on our own oxygen masks before we can support those around us. And I'm going to be talking about the vaccination of school staff, because it has actually turned out to be a quite controversial topic in recent days due to the success of a highly aggressive media campaign. But I would be betraying my trade union ideals if I didn't address this when given the platform. So all along, trade unions have campaigned for safety at work, and that is their raison d'etre. And a pandemic does not change that. And it is incredulous that people within our communities would get tricked by the misleading headlines that teachers want to push past the elderly and the medically vulnerable. At no point have the leaderships of the trade unions called for this, nor did they call for education staff to receive vaccine prioritization over other frontline workers, such as healthcare professionals. Since the school closures in January, when we were seeing 8,000 cases a day, all partners in education have wanted schools to reopen, but safely and in line with public health advice. And it was for that reason, and to prevent further disruptions to classes, as well as health complications for staff, that the government agreed to put us in Category 9. And that's what we're seeking. It's a twin track approach so that education staff can be vaccinated in tandem with other priority groups. And over the last few days, I've heard many media pundits pose the loaded question to trade union leaders of who are you proposing that you take the place of? And it's a false dichotomy, and we need to call it. You need to ask yourself, when was the last time that you were in a room of 50 square meters with 27 other people for hours at a time, and none of them were wearing masks? And there's no comparison between our work and that of someone working from home. I was not at the same risk during remote teaching as I am in the classroom, and I don't think that should be a controversial thing to say. So as parents, we trust teachers with gorgeous, precious children every day for their holistic development. And teachers are expected to model a good moral compass throughout our work and in our personal lives. Yet we're the human embodiment of greed and countless other negative traits, going by the vitriol that I've seen online this week. So which is it? No other profession has mud slung at them in such a coordinated way as this on a regular basis. And messages have come in to me from colleagues in our WhatsApp groups that we are actually genuinely concerned about the impact that this is going to be having on school staff's mental health, because there's only so much you can take. So my message of hope is that education staff are finally finding their voices, and it has caused them through sheer necessity to become assertive enough to speak up for themselves. It's also been a catalyst for us to forge strong ties of solidarity between us. Primary teachers, secondary teachers, SNAs have been doing fantastic advocacy group in the last 2 weeks, and also our school secretaries. So for anyone listening to this, please push back against the narrative and remember that everyone deserves a safe working environment, and Workers United can never be defeated.
Thanks so much, Jana. And I think that, you know, it's been horrendous to see how teachers have been spoken about again in the media. And, you know, it's such, going back to what Lynn said at the start about, you know, having the ability to acknowledge failure and making mistakes, and that the government did not have the maturity to say, you know, this is a change. This is a very significant change. We want to talk to you about this. We want to engage in this. And not just you, but also we know there's other frontline workers, you know, like childcare workers, for example, you know, like guards as well, who are in the front line, who, of course, are at more risk and of exposure to the virus. And, you know, to not acknowledge that, and to, you know, to, again, for this divisive, you know, way that it's been portrayed, it has been horrendous. And it saddened me as a parent, you know, and that we are a community, parents, teachers, together. And I think that there is, while there's a lot of that in the media, there's also a lot of solidarity for you. And I think that, you know, we appreciate everything that you're doing. And going into school, and as schools open next week, the teachers will be back there, despite that feeling of unsafe and despite that lack of prioritization. And I think that, you know, there is a real need, a question of why it can't be done, as you've said. Why can't it be done parallel?
Yeah, I think Rory, like, why can't it be done in parallel is exactly the question. So it's kind of like, for me, you know, in relation to vaccinating teachers, it makes so much sense, right? Like, without getting into the argument of teachers being back and work, not work, because I have obviously views on what should be continuing and what shouldn't and all of that. But in terms of vaccinations, right, it's like they've managed to pit a group of people against each other rather than focus on the inadequacy of the vaccine rollout. So it's like, you know, it's on a completely different scale. But like, when we look at housing, it's like, house your own. Who do you want to be housed in front of? Who do you want to receive that funding? Do you not want that? Very important. So it's like, it's like one of those scenarios where we create a situation where people attack each other. The working class attack each other. The professions that deserve the protection attack each other. And we ignore the fact that the system that should be making it that everybody is being vaccinated in an adequate amount of time in relation to the profession and the service that they provide is just a normal thing. Like, the fact that teachers want to be vaccinated ahead of anyone, that narrative is created purely and solely to create a situation whereby we attack each other. Like, that is an attacking lion, because it's like, oh, you want something ahead of me? Well, you're not getting it because I'm sick and you're this and you're that. And it's like, it should never be like that. You know, we shouldn't be creating those narratives or those kind of ideas. And you know, so the fact that even the guards, like, I know, like, whatever about the guards being vaccinated, right? I won't go there on the guards, right? But what I will say is that the guards are still raiding houses at the minute, right? And in some occasions, I've had people that rang me and said, I've asked the guard that raided my house and actually raided the wrong house, so misidentified the person where he was raiding in Rialto and raided the wrong house, and he refused to, the guard refused to put on his mask. So that family was saying, would someone vaccinate the guards? Like, because they're just like, so it's not that like I'm saying vaccinate the guards because like the guards need protection from us. I'm also saying protect, vaccinate the guards because we need,
right. And it's guards, yeah. Know? And Lynn, if I could just come in there, it's the same, you know, you could use the same argument for teachers, not that we're raiding anyone's houses, yeah, but toy houses maybe, but
is transactional.
Well, that's it. And like, if you think now, like, so all schools, you would hope now have their children sitting at their table groups and the children don't really move around the class, but the teacher does. Like, I have first class, so they're 7, and I've loads of children with English as an additional language and with literacy difficulties and everything else. As much as you'd like to, you can't teach from the whiteboard. That's not what my job is. I'm double masking and I'm going in there on a wing and a prayer every day. And I'm the one who's physically moving around the room. If I have anything on me, on my hands or whatever, I'm going to be the one passing it from one table to the other. Do you know what I mean? So like if I wake up with a cough, like I had to self-isolate there for 3 days, even though I got my COVID test back negative within 24 hours, but you have to wait for the 48 hours after you're free. So economically, it makes sense. Socially, for the kids, it makes sense. And we don't have the subs to cover all the COVID leave. So I know we've been going on for ages, so I'll leave it at that.
No, I think, John, it's really, you know, there is so much there and there's so much in you know, what... It's just horrible to see that lack of solidarity. And it comes back to, you know, what type of society, you know, we're trying to create and what type of society government is trying to create. And I think it really does question that leadership, you know, of what type of society you're trying to promote. And we need to promote one of solidarity. So appreciate all you're doing. Really do. Thank you.
Yeah, so that was Lynn, Ruan. It was obviously myself. It was Leo, Cliona and Jana. And really, I think they gave a really interesting and provocative and thought-provoking and inspiring kind of introduction to an overview of some of the key inequalities and hopes as well. What did you think of it, Tony?
Well, I'm gonna give you a bit of faint praise here and say your son did very well. he really did. He absolutely did. And I thought that was a really great little conversation. And of course, Lynn is always worth the price of admission. I mean,
she is, isn't she? She's incredible.
She really is. She's felt like, I mean, I don't want to single her out, but I'm a big fan as you know, and as she knows. So, but I mean, you can't, Cliona has always been very kind to us and given her time, but she's an exceptional person and doing exceptional work. And again, Jana is always clued in. Jana knows and is, you know, speaks with authority. I mean, she works in the sector. She knows what it's about. It's not like we're talking to, you know, a social justice warrior. When you hear from Jana, you're hearing from someone who is working with students, working with pupils and trying to do the best for them in difficult circumstances. And I think you could hear in her voice the level of disappointment on some of the changes that have happened, you know, from that. So I think that's, you know, I mean,
I absolutely agree with you. And I think, again, I was struck with all of them that the amazing thing about these podcasts, and not just Reboot Republic, but across the Tortoise Track, is giving the time to people like that to be able to reflect a bit and to be able to offer a bit of a broader opinion. And you just, I think it's so much deeper and more valuable than the mainstream media, where everything is pressure to make some, you know, really, you know, controversial point. And it's, you know, it's all pitting people against each other. And I just was really struck by, between Leo, like, you know, I'm so proud of him, but, you know, having the little bit of time to talk about, you know, what he thought about as a young person, what was important, you know, hearing Cliona kind of reflect a bit broader in terms of what we're doing about vaccines, as you say as well, about Jana talking about, you know, the vitriol that's been targeted at teachers. And again, of course, Lynn, you know, so always bringing up perspectives of class. And I just, it reminded me of how important, you know, Reboot is and the space it gives to voices like that.
Yeah, no, and I think there's a lot to be said, a lot of feedback for the people who actually listen to the full thing, because as you said, it's available, that you get the whole thing on patreon.com / Tortoise Shack, and it's 2 hours, 32 minutes, but it had to be.
Yeah,
it actually had to be.
We couldn't stop them. Like,
no,
there's no way you could. you could stop people like that, you know, talk. It wouldn't have been right. And even though we had planned for an hour, I think it was even 45 minute podcast.
I wanted 45 minutes, but that was wishful thinking. If you could just say one thing at the end though about that, and I know it sounds really cheesy, but if you do want change, just shows you do have to invest in it. You know,
you do. You absolutely do. But like, and the time that, you know, all of the speakers, all of the guests put in, you know, the time that you put into it, the time that I put into it, you know, that the support that patrons give us is absolutely essential. And it wouldn't, you know, we wouldn't be continuing for 3 years if we didn't have that, if we didn't put in that, said if we didn't have the support from listeners and patrons.
People don't understand how vulnerable it actually is as a model. Mm. That's the disappointing thing in a way, because you see everything growing, everything going well, but you just understand, like, people, like, you know, they will say to you, oh, look, it's a podcast. It's not a podcast. It's a podcast platform that shares a space for people, that gives them an opportunity to raise their voices and discuss things at length in a non...
adversarial.
It doesn't even... Yeah, okay, that's fair. But I also don't think we don't do it for clicks. We don't do it for that. We do it because we believe in the work, and it matters. And thousands of people listen. And you need that space. I mean, I don't want to, and again, just to put this, I want to say this, because if anybody's listening, just to be very clear, there's producers, there's IT people, there's graphics that is designed, there's music people that put our stuff together, there's all of these things, and people have to be paid. We have to walk the walk.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You have to be true. Like, it's very, so it's unfortunate where people think that, you know, the content might be free, but that doesn't mean that it doesn't have a value. I'm sorry now to go on that rant, but it just gets...
No, I think it's important. You know, again, your time, my time, you know, it all costs, as you say, it costs to produce, it costs to host in terms of the platforms that it's on, in terms of the servers and all that. It all costs money to as particularly when we're reaching the extent of the audience that we're reaching now in terms of thousands of listeners. Which is wonderful, but it does cost. We're an independent media where we have no sponsorship, we have no ads. And so while it feels like, you know, we're plugging, it's important that listeners know this. And I think, you know, as listeners do understand that and value it, hopefully they will support us and go over to patreon.com/tortoiseshack and, you know, sign up, get across the podcast from across the platform. You get 2.5 hour live podcast. You get access to the next live ones. And we will be doing another live one in the next couple of months for definite, Tony. I think it was a great success.
There's regular live podcasts. They're every Sunday, but that one was like, that one was gangbusters, and we will continue to do them, and we will be going live when we can. Right. We leave it there, Rory, and keep an eye out for the part two, because I will be editing it myself and putting it together. We'll be in your feeds.
As always, fair play, Tony. Thanks. And thanks to listeners, and we'll talk to you soon.